This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 235, Thoughts on the Tube. Hello, this is Michael Martin, one of two co-hosts, both named Michael, welcoming you yet again to GamesAtWork.biz. So, hey, Michael, it's going to be a fun Friday for us to talk about tech and VR and all kinds of stuff. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just well, even if I come blasting through your speakers.
Directly into your ears.
Into ear holes.
200 watts of power.
Yeah, I'm in a different location than usual. It's a little bit echoey. I apologize in advance, and I'll try to do what I can during the edit.
Echo, echo. Well, we'll just pretend you're in the Grand Canyon. That'll be fun.
Canyon.
So, look, we've got a fabulous show here. And to kick it off, you know, we've been talking about bots and robots and droids and stuff for a long time. A favorite of ours is, of course, the iRobot family of bots. And I couldn't believe when I was reading these links here that it's like 30 years old now. Can you believe that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you remember I had the iRobot in my apartment back in 2006, and I loved it. It was really cool.
That's right. And so that was one of the really early versions of it. And I guess they're all controllable by your phone. I think that was there too. You could kind of, you know, be a vacuum pilot around your apartment.
No. I had the very original one, and basically it did a random walk through your space, and based off of that, it just ran long enough to where eventually it would have cleaned the whole house.
did you have the original virtual fences too to prevent it from like falling downstairs alone or in pairs?
Yeah, you had this little adapter that you put down, and that would try to keep it from crossing I guess it was like an IR beam that it would sense, and when it hit that IR beam, it would bounce back.
Yeah. So what I'm finding intriguing, so the first article here talks about there's two of these robots from iRobot. You've got one that does the mopping, and you got one that does the vacuuming. And apparently they work in tandem to better operate and clean your place one with another. So yes, that seems pretty intriguing. What I wasn't getting here was, you know, where does one begin and the other one end? And, you know, how do they tell? Mop here, vacuum there, and, you know, don't mix the two because you don't want to wind up mopping your carpet, right?
Yeah, I thought that was really cool, actually. It made sense to me that the mop one would try to go first, and then if it saw something that was vacuumable.
Yes.
Then it would say, yo, can you come over here and clean this up? And then based off of that, it would address everything else, which I thought that was really cool. And because they're all now able to talk through, you know, either Wi-Fi, through the cell phone, through, you know, any type of IP environment, it does give you the ability to learn more of the environment and based off that environment decide what to do. Because the one that I had was just the vacuum, which was more or less a glorified sweeper, right?
Right.
So
right,
it had
right.
the little rolling pin. The amount of real vacuum that it did was nowhere near like even little hand vac. And so when it transitioned from the carpet to the linoleum in the kitchen area, it would keep going, and basically at that point, it truly is just sweeping everything up. What would be better is when it hit that, if it just said, wait a minute, turned around and said, you know, whistle, come over here, clean this part. This is linoleum.
It's not me. This is you. It's not you. It's me.
It's not me, my it's job. You do it.
Well, I was intrigued too about the whole clean base new piece here as well, because I can imagine that it would be tedious to have to go to the little bot, open it up, shake it out, you know, put it back and say, okay, go clean some more. But now these robots can, it looks like they can empty themselves of things that they have swept up. And for the mopping one, it almost looked like, is that like a water tank or something that allows it to do a little more mopping?
Yeah, that wasn't clear to me. The fact that even in my little tiny, what was it, 675 square foot apartment that I had in New York, every time it did one clean of the apartment, I would have to dump the little container out and even use like a comb to kind of peel the stuff off the brush head.
Right.
It was a big pain. So the fact that they actually have a built-in garbage collection that lets it go many, many, many times before you have to dump something else, I think that's really cool. And the mop one, well, that's the thing that's not clear. Looking at the picture, mm-hmm. I can't decide if the black one is the mop or the regular the regular vacuum.
I think it's the vacuum, and I think the white one is the mop.
Yeah, and if the white one's the mop, there's almost, you know, there's not much container at all for incremental water in the stand. So I think only one that actually has the updated system for cleaning it out and keeping on is mm-hmm. the vacuum.
Well, so let's move off of the first one from the TechCrunch and move into the second article from ZDNet, which is the one that I found super intriguing, because this is now talking about the history of the company and where iRobot is heading. And the first phrase that kind of grabbed me here was the company is moving from saying, hey, buy this robot, to, hey, enjoy this service. Mm-hmm. And as different companies are moving much more in a services angle, this makes much more sense, where it's, in this case, we have a hardware powered by software service delivery mechanism. And I could see where there could be some really intriguing business models, not just now, but in the future, of it being a service for cleaning your house, just to start with that, and that these bots, just a major weird wacko idea just kind of popped to mind here, is that a bot could be delivered to your home, provide the service, and then go away. And then as the technology evolves and upgrades and so on over time, instead of having like a little puppy door, you might have a bot door for your house, and you would welcome in these bots, and that would be authenticated to be able to do the service for your home. And it's more of the service that you're purchasing versus the bot. But in the beginning, like for you, Michael, it really was, hey, this is a really cool piece of technology, and you wanted to experience the technology and the robotics first.
Well, right? Not only that, I was up on the assignment, and I like to have the floor, you know, the carpet nicely vacuumed, and it was something I could literally kick off every other day and just keep it nicely done. And the whole idea of cleaning as a service, or even beyond that, right? Because they have the lawnmower too, right? Mm-hmm. So it's almost like tidy by service, right? Because you want a tidy yard and a tidy carpet and tidy floors, right? You don't want a bunch of junk on them. So the basic idea of switching from selling a product to selling a service is something that we've seen transitioning for really 20 years,
right?
Going all the way back to usage-based driving insurance back in, was it 2002?
Yeah, it was with Standard Life and Company, I think, where the first guys doing some of that sort of thing
in the UK, wasn't Prudential, it? I thought. One of the P's. Mm-hmm. And then you got into the whole, you know, tires by the mile, right?
Right.
That Continental and another tire company did. And so now we've got, you know, driving by mile, right, with Uber and Car2Go and all these other services. So having the idea of tidy by the dollar makes a lot of sense. And because each one of their robots is designed to fulfill a specific niche service, it's really easy to monetize this. Because you can say, I care about carpets, but not about the floor. I care about the yard, but not about the carpet, etc. And you can buy that service. Right? And the fact that they now have a dumper, right, for the vacuum one means that they can use an autonomous vehicle with, you know, racks and racks of these devices in it, drive them down a street, you know, at
deploy them
in front of the houses. They all go it through the little robot door, vacuum everything up, come back in and fill it back up, go to the next street. It logically makes so much sense. And it's, I don't know if you remember, but we used to actually have an iRobot division in the park here. They worked on the underwater military robots and That's research right. robots, right? Mm-hmm. Which they sold off a while back. But the fact that they have decided, we are a consumer company, we know that this is a service that people need, but they don't want to have to deal with, just makes such logical sense to me.
Yeah, I'm geeking out on this in a big, big way. And like I said, that notion just struck me of the pet door, the robot door to allow these kind of services. And I love the way you describe Tidy as a service. So we've been watching on Netflix some of the Marie Kondo stuff, and there are aspects of the way that she considers tidying and the way of displaying things like clothing and how you fold up your shirts so that in your drawer you can see all of your shirts at the same time as opposed to them being stacks and stacks. So you could imagine that if iRobot is moving in the direction of smart home and a smart tidy home, you could do other things like this too, right? Well, where you could do the laundry, you could do the putting things away, you could have the dishwasher and other aspects that were enabled by robotic cleanliness as opposed to by human or augmented human kind of stuff right now, which is really what a dishwasher does for you to wash things faster, better through a machine.
Yeah, we'll have to find the article, but I mean, you mentioned laundry, and I remember us looking at last year or year before, or even year before that, the laundry folding robot, right?
Yeah, I remember that
too. That was a Kickstarter. It was all over CES for years, and I think they have finally gone out of business ever actually shipping the product.
Well, it's a hard problem to solve, you know?
Yeah.
But not impossible. Not impossible. And if you can imagine, you know, the robot that we were talking about with Ford from last week, you know, delivered to the home, comes on in, does its thing, goes away. Right. So it could very well be that a model like this is the service model that could be very useful and that would have other possibilities. Right. You might have a chef robot that could come to your home and create something for you fresh using your kitchen. And when you arrive for dinner, it is ready to go, right?
Yep.
Be another thing. So the article here that you found, the intriguing things to me were talking about the challenges, the compute power challenges that are really required by a company like iRobot. So handling all the mapping of the home, doing it in a way that inspires trust and confidence, because there are lots of articles, and not just about iRobot, but others, about how do you maintain your privacy and your trust, and that you don't want to have your data about what's happening in your home, video from your home, audio from your home, going places where you don't want it to go. And iRobot's done has a major focus in that space, according to this article. And the underlying technology architecture of using the data where you need to and using the cloud provided compute power on demand to do the heavy lifting, so to speak. To me, it was another intriguing way of taking advantage of compute at scale for the smaller task of doing something like this in your home with privacy. What did you take away from that?
Well, when I think about the compute power aspect in general, and you kind of hit on parts of it, right? In any type of machine learning environment, there's two components. There's the model learning and then the model execution, for lack of...
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you need a heck of a lot more power to build the model than it is to execute the model, right? So you can you can build the model up on the cloud through a server farm, whatever. And then once you package that down, we've saw things, you know, last year at WWDC, Apple showed off how they shrunk their machine learning execution down to, you know, I think it was 1/10 of the size. And then Google at their developer conference a couple of weeks ago were talking about, you know, like two orders of magnitude down on the size of their models, et cetera, so that they could actually do their entire assistant locally on the device, right, without hitting the cloud. And so the idea that I need a very, very powerful device to clean my house is a fallacy, because it can go down to very simple rules as defined by the model, but all the data that you collect across all the houses, et cetera, to build that model requires huge amount of compute power. And I think it's fascinating how they've, you know, over time have used that knowledge and learning in the models to simplify the product ultimately.
Well, right, and the notion of simplifying the product and simplifying the underlying code to take advantage of those models is a challenge that many companies have, and it seems like they've done the right balance point here of ensuring that they're investing in the future and future capabilities while at the same time maintaining the environment that they need to for all of the older systems that are still working. Right, yeah. It's still running.
I think this quote is attributed to Einstein, that said, "You should make a problem as simple as possible, but not simpler," or something close to that. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something. I remember that too. Yes.
Yeah, and
not any simpler than it needs to be.
Yeah. And when you think again about machine learning and how all these types of services will ultimately work. I think that's a direct way of thinking about it.
Wow. That's how machine learning, privacy, robotics, home use, I mean, all wrapped up here in one, really incredible kind of stuff.
Just so that I don't have to sweep my floor.
Just so you don't have to sweep your floor, because we know what kind of, you know, time saving that would be on a daily basis, and how much your time is worth. So you can cost that out.
Yes.
Which is the intriguing thing of making this a service as opposed to a product that performs a service.
Right.
So stay tuned. Let's see what happens with this area of robotics, shall we? If we walk outside the home, though, for a moment. And we want to have a portable VR experience. We've seen this before, but it was an article that I saw recently about a brand new version of Hewlett-Packard's virtual reality backpack.
Yes.
And so the image of this is really pretty cool, about a person who's able to walk around in the full 360 degree field as they need to, strapped on their back the compute power that they need and battery and everything else, and be able to interact with the virtual reality world that's around them. So I was intrigued by this. I thought it was pretty cool the way it looked and operated. And at the same time, I was like, okay, as neat as this is, you're still interacting with a VR environment, and you're potentially bumping into stuff that you don't really want to.
That was my exact thought. I'm like, wow, this is great. Now I can do VR and smack into walls. And I get it. I think there are definitely specific, really industrial use cases where this may be helpful.
Right.
But I can't imagine that there are a lot of those. and that they justify a dedicated device like this, which is why, you know, as we were looking this up in the pre-show, I pinged the article from Nreal and their AR glasses, which they do the same thing in that you have displays on your eyes and offload everything else into compute power. And in HP's example, that compute power is a desktop computer on your back with multiple batteries that are hot swappable, et cetera, et cetera. And in Nreal's AR example, it's a cell phone, right?
Right.
The power of the cell phone has gotten us to the point where AR is completely reasonable I won't even say a high-end cell phone anymore. It's a mid-range cell phone that you can use to power this. Now, VR has more polygons and more rendering, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But from a standpoint of use cases, VR to me is kind of the ultimate extension of covering up the real world in AR.
Yes.
Right? And so to address that safety concern of walking into the wall with that backpack on, maybe you need to have a little bit of a hole that looks out onto the real world. Well, now I'm in AR, so why don't I just have a cell phone in my pocket and some really good screens on my eyes?
Yeah, exactly. Like these Nreal versions or something along those lines.
Or something along that line. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I think we've been singing this particular refrain now for a while. And perhaps VR is still just that stepping stone as you go here, or perhaps there are like dedicated spaces, kind of like if you were going to go play laser tag or something, you would do this somewhere else and you would give it a shot in a dedicated space where the VR experience would be the way to go. I don't know. We'll see. We'll continue to see,
to see part of it.
So, talking about interacting with computers, and we've talked about the visual interaction, there is an awful lot of gesture interaction that still exists. And there's an interesting article that you found here, Michael, about Leap Motion and what's happening with that company right now.
Yeah, this is really interesting because we've talked about Leap technology in the past before. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, for some reason,
didn't you have one? I thought you had one.
I was saying, for some reason, I believe this was the same technology that I have the little keyboard. I think mm-hmm. that's a Leap keyboard, where it casts a infrared red light keyboard on a flat surface and identifies breaking of the light with your finger to have you actually type on anything as a keyboard.
Right.
And it didn't take off very well. It looked great in movies, right? Because it was kind of cool science fiction looking stuff.
Right.
But because of the flatness of the surface and the fact that when I type, the palm of my hand kind of rests and then my fingers type. And if you lifted your palms up and you just had your fingers touching, it typed better with this, right? But what's interesting here was the fact that Apple tried to buy these guys at one point in time. And you think about what Apple's trying to do with AR.
Right.
You know, and the fact that, the ability to do very detailed hand tracking for AR and VR is a key requirement for a lot of these systems, right? So I found it interesting about this article, you know, that they were almost nabbed away years ago by Apple. Mm-hmm. That this is the tech that we really, really need in a lot of our worlds, right? So Ultra Haptics, I guess, was the company that bought them recently.
Yep. I'm looking at their website now, too. So it looks like the Stratus Inspire haptic module is exactly what takes advantage of this technology, mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm. And maybe for use cases like I'm at a kiosk and I want to order something This would be a great way to interact in a more sanitary fashion. For example, if I'm going to be at a fast food joint and I don't want to touch the same keyboard or the same touch screen that everybody else has been touching right before they eat too, this could be a good thing, right?
Yep. Very cool.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So moving right along, we've touched on VR. We've talked about some robotics. We've talked about some interaction points. I think it's time to hit a few on the games side of the house, or at least a little bit. And the one that caught my attention, is a new version of Pokemon. And where Pokemon really got people out and about and exercising and closing their rings by catching these little virtual monsters and finding gyms and all that, there is a new app coming from the Pokemon company called Pokemon Sleep. And
it's like the anti-Pokemon Go.
it kind of is. But given all the research on sleep, how important sleep is, blah, 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 this could be really an intriguing way of saying, hey, you need to get your rest in order that you can perform at your top capability. And boy, you know, if people decide that they want to game the game, so to speak, wouldn't it be neat for them to have to put down their devices for a period of time and not use them? And that would be a good thing too.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The whole Pokemon Go, etc. phenomenon. I was listening to, it might have been MacBreak, and Leo Laporte was talking about, you know, there are devices now that will auto spin the Pokestops to get you new Pokeballs, right? Mm-hmm. So as you're walking around, you don't even think about it. It just captures them for you.
Right.
So the whole original design was get people out, get them to do exercise, you know, have them interact with each other at Pokestops, blah, 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 blah. Then it's like, oh, that's just too much. That's too hard. I'm going to make them be able to catch the Pokeballs for free by just having this device. And now it's like, and then we're going to allow them to keep playing while they're sleeping.
Yeah.
But no, I do like the idea that what the real idea here is to encourage sleep tracking, right? Mm-hmm. And I use a sleep tracker on my watch. I've been doing that for years. I find the data fascinating. I used to use it when I had the old Fitbit, et cetera. And it's interesting. I don't know what it really helps me with.
But you like looking at it.
I like looking at the data, and then it's like, okay, you know, I feel like crap this morning. I know I didn't sleep well. Oh, look, I looked at the data. I didn't sleep well. or oh, crap, I didn't sleep well. Now I feel bad. What am I going to do about it tonight? Tonight I'm really going to sleep. If I don't sleep tonight, I'm going to really work hard to sleep.
That's funny. I used to have the Jawbone Up, and I loved that. Yeah. And what I loved about that was how it would use the haptics to gently wake you up, because it would vibrate to wake you up.
Yeah.
And I love that. But my Jawbone Up failed, unfortunately. It up and died. And so you're using an earlier Apple Watch now as kind of your sleep tracking, right?
Yeah.
So you've got a day watch or a night watch. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so mine is always charging, so I'm not doing a lot of sleep tracking on mine. Oh, but maybe in the future. Now, babies like sleeping, don't they?
I think some of them are professionals.
That they probably, yeah, they've gone pro at such an early age. And music is a useful thing to help babies sleep too. But this article from, what was it, Eureka Alert?
Yes.
Is something that's a little bit different than the two of those. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I've got multiple people in my family who are in nursing, and my sister actually works in neonatal, and this article was about how they did some research around how music can help in brain development, both in the neonatal intensive care unit. as well as other conditions of the environment of very young babies and children, right? And as somebody who is brain biased, I guess.
So you are in favor of brains, basically.
I really am. And brains have always fascinated me, like brains and eyes, right? And when my sister was really early in her career, I visited her one time, and she showed me, you know, these premature, very underdeveloped babies and stuff. And it was just heartbreaking. And as someone who loves music and is fascinated about brain development, this article was actually really interesting to me. And, you know, what type of music? Is it based off of the complexity of the music? Is it, you know, will thrash metal help your baby? anyway, I just found it really interesting. I actually shared this with my sister. I haven't heard back from her yet to say, you know, what type of music do you guys play in your neonatal unit, et cetera.
Right. I thought it was interesting how the snake charmer's flute generated a lot of reactions. The punji, I guess, is what it is. So it's like, you know, that was kind of intriguing. And gosh, with our kids, you know, baby Mozart and stuff was kind of a popular thing for kids to increase their cognitive powers, if you will. And we're big believers in all this as well, because music has a direct relationship to mathematics,
yep,
which has a direct relationship then to ability to operate in this complex world that we all live in.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Western music has very specific scales and tones.
Right.
And patterns that's different than other musics from different parts around the globe. And I always wondered, when people equate music to mathematics, if they are considering it only from a Western music perspective, or do things like chromatic tones and other scales have the same mathematical underpinning that impacts cognitive development?
Yeah, it's an intriguing thought.
Yeah, I don't have an answer. It's just it's one of those things that just I think about, because, you know, people who are pitch perfect, right? They hear those major tone scales, but do they really hear, you know, the dissonant tones, et cetera, in the same way?
Yeah, and there's such a cultural element to all this as well.
Exactly.
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention or plug for a moment to the book from my mother-in-law that she's co-author on, dealing with music and development and mathematics. The book's called A Well-Tempered Mind, Using Music to Help Children Listen and Learn. So make sure that I put that into the show notes as well. An intriguing thing that occurred with the team, the symphony in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and connecting in with local school systems there to help children actually develop additional skills as well. Love it.
Very cool. Very cool. And does one of those tones go do 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 do?
Well, it should. You know, the Cantina Band is an important song, and for those of us who have been waiting, and yes, waiting some more, it's time.
Yes.
Disney has now opened up the Black Spire Outpost in Batu, and it is
also
time
known
to
as
go
Los Angeles.
Yeah, or Anaheim, if we're going to be really, really particular, right?
Close enough.
Yeah, so everybody seems to be talking about it this week. You can go to Disney. You can get your 4 hours in to the Star Wars land. And And boy, there are so many things to check out, see, and do. And I think from all the videos that I've seen on this so far, and I haven't looked at a lot, but I've looked at a few, the Easter eggs that are built in there are some of the most intriguing things, where all the decorations and the reality creation that Disney does so well is a feast for the eyes. And the environment, the land, even the waiting periods, that's the ride.
Yeah.
Right. And I've not read enough about this yet, but the line rides, you know, while you're waiting to actually pilot the Millennium Falcon and punch it into hyperspeed, light speed, there are games that you play on your devices to keep you occupied and entertained, and that get you into character for all the various things that you might do. So there definitely is a gaming angle to all this, so we can include it.
Games on lines.
Games on lines. Better than snakes on a Millennium Falcon.
Yes.
We are.
I'm so glad you caught my really bad rendition of the Cantina Band.
I knew what you meant. I kind of was guessing, and
I heard it in my head. It sounded much better than what came out of my mouth.
It was better, certainly in your head, I'm sure. And there was an Apple IIe game that had the Cantina Band as the background music for it. So we can figure out what that was, that would be a great little Easter egg we can add to all of this as well.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, we're about at time, which is too bad because there's even more stuff to talk about, but we're kind of where we need to be. So drop us a line. Tell us what you think. If you find a favorite Easter egg in Star Wars land, you know, let us know. Help people be on the look for it. And gosh, Michael, where can people find us if they're hunting to look to engage with us here on GamesAtWork.biz?
Well, they can find me next week at WWDC. So I will not be doing a show next week, but you can check out my blog at MichaelRose01.com, where I will be talking about my second year at WWDC and my experiences. But if you want to talk to us, go to GamesAtWork.biz or at Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz.
Well, Michael, enjoy next week. I can't wait to read about your adventures and the things that you're learning and all the good fun stuff that'll be announced in the keynote that we'll be tuning in and watching. So have a lot of fun.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Yeah.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.